Hello, I'm Tom Kelly, and welcome to the Proctor Podcast. I'm delighted to introduce you to the first episode of a unique online series, which over the next several months will feature segments from Phil Proctor's recently published memoir, Where's My Fortune Cookie? Taken directly from Phil's musings about his life and membership with the legendary four-man, thrice Grammy-nominated satirical comedy group, Firesign Theater, this series weaves its way from his formative years, when he was first introduced to showbiz at a very early age, to the roller coaster ride that was Firesign Theater. Called the Beatles of Comedy by the Library of Congress, where their hilarious recordings are now archived, Firesign Theater helped give voice to many of Phil's characters, which led him to further and very successfully explore voice acting for film, TV, and more. Phil's readings of Fortune Cookie is funny and revealing and filled with sonic moments and memories from his life. Since the print version, co-authored by Brad Schreiber and available at Amazon.com, is profusely illustrated, our director, Sue Zizza, and master engineer David Shin of Sue Media Productions have added music, audio bites, and sound effects to enhance your listening pleasure. So, here goes. In this first episode, after a personal introduction to his story, Phil dives right in, or rather, dives under a table, and tells us how he survived the Golden Dragon Massacre, an infamous early mass shooting at a famous San Francisco restaurant in 1977.
A forward into the past. Half of what I remember never happened. Mark Twain. What is reality? The Firesign Theater. Dear friends, this book starts off with a bang, or several, as you'll soon learn. And it's not your typical biography, because I have, I believe, not lived a typical life. Or maybe I have. You'll have to tell me, since time is an illusion of sorts, and I believe that we exist as much in the minds of others as we do in our own. It's a crazy chronicle, at best, which I hope will inspire you to listen to your own inner voices and trust in higher consciousness to guide you on your way to enlightenment, or at least to a feeling of personal fulfillment and self-realization, as you too represent a significant sliver of potential in this shattered, isolated experience we call existence on this dimension, Earth. Serendipity rules. The book is based on taped interviews I did with my co-author and friend, funny man Brad Schreiber, who coerced me over breakfast one morning to begin the challenging task of telling my story before I could no longer remember it. Maybe he was too late, but you'll never know. And I've done my best to protect others from embarrassment, or me from lawsuits, by eliminating some turbulent times. In other words, may my lost years remain lost. I'm still alive and kicking, so who cares? Finally, a huge thank you to all those whose support and love have contributed to the birth of the book. My daughter Kristen, and her husband Jeff, and my grandkids Bowen and Audrey. The Firesign Theater, Phil, Pete, and Dave, and Andy Thomas, and Taylor Jessen, and Brad, and Jamie Alcroft for dragging me onto boomers on a bench. Thank me, and I'm welcome. Phil Proctor. Try the Duck. You'll notice that the subtitle of this book is my psychic, surrealistic story, because beyond being functionally illiterate, my life seems to be punctuated with the sort of improbable premonitions and creepy close calls that might comfortably comprise an episode of The Twilight Zone. Perhaps all of our lives are adrift in this surreal domain, but it is the unique blessing or curse of artists to be acutely aware of and informed by the psychic currents that swirl around us.
It is the connective tissue between us, the glue that bonds actor and audience, and it's a heavy responsibility to remain lighthearted. My life has been in collaboration with gifted colleagues on stage and on the page, and I've come to understand that performing is not just a matter of remembering lines and hitting your marks. It's about celebrating the human condition. It's an expression of love, and love is not linear. So like all the best stories, allow me to start in the middle. The last album Firesign Theatre did for Columbia Records, In the Next World You're on Your Own, 1975, had a hidden meaning for not only listeners but for me as well, because 2 years later, my comedy partner Peter Bergman and I would stare death in the face in one of the first major American mass shootings. The album was written by Dave Ossman and Phil Austin, but featured all four of our voices. It opens with "Police Straight," a wacky send-up of cop shows in which we hear a burst of gunfire and a police radio call about unarmed tourist victims.
Correction, one unarmed tourist. The other two had arms.
Little did we know that something like this would actually happen to us in the early morning hours of September 4th, 1977. Soon after the release of that record, David took his job in Washington, D.C. with NPR, allowing Peter and me to resume our crazy career on the road. But during a break in the action, Barbro, my wife, and I went to visit her family in Oslo and were ready to enjoy a scenic drive up to Bergen on the coast. Along the way, we'd booked a sleepover at a hotel high up in the glaciers, and when we pulled up to park, we were startled to see scores of the same sparkling, all-silver cars parked in front. Inside, things got even weirder as we witnessed trays of brandy and snifters being delivered to swarms of Norwegian men dressed identically in white suits, white shoes, and black shirts with white ties. Curious, we asked one of the guys what the heck was going on, and he said, "Vi kjører best, vi kler best, vi drikker best, vi spiser best, vi den best." The Norwegian may not be entirely accurate, but the translation is, "We drive the best, we dress the best, we drink the best, we eat the best, we are the best." Turned out to be a big group of salesmen at a retreat for Findus Frozen Foods, a division of the Pillsbury Company in Scandinavia. And Don Pillsbury, a scion of the dynasty, was one of my Yale buds in Scroll and Key, no less. So, after hearing their story and toasting Skål many times, we retired to our room and made the best. Our daughter, Kristen. When we returned in mid-August, it was time for another Procter & Bergman tour, and Barbro was intent on joining us for our upcoming gig in San Francisco. We had plans to meet up for a bite after the show with our friend Bill Alexander, a psychiatrist who lives in Tiburon in Marin County. How ironic that there was a doctor with us when we all almost lost our lives. Back in L.A., Pete was still living up the street in the quaint little Swiss chalet on Wanda Park Drive and planned to pick us up for the drive to the airport. But right before he arrived, Barbro got a call from her doctor who informed her, in news that blew us away, she was preggers. We talked excitedly over coffee about this unexpected turn of events and how it might change our life together, but we were both too stunned to absorb all the implications. And then I realized I had to finish packing. We toured so often, it was always easy to throw things together at the last minute. "You know something, Philip," Barbro said. "I think I'd better stay home and absorb this." I didn't protest. I was still numb myself, and we hadn't previously discussed parenthood. I'd helped raise Amanda, my foster child, with my first wife, but I'd assumed I wasn't going to be a father again. It started raining hard outside. "That's another reason I should stay at home," Barbro said, indicating the weather. Our street in Benedict Canyon, Beverly Hills adjacent, was just paved with tar at the time, and the torrential rains had already caused local problems. Mudslides, drooping trees, sewers backing up, and a plague of frogs. The usual L.A. problems during the rainy seasons we had before climate change plunged us into a prolonged drought. So, Peter and I traveled to Los Angeles International Airport without Barbro. I remember growing upset by the news of the unexpected pregnancy. Immature as I still was at the ripe old age of 37, that eventually yielded our beautiful, talented daughter, Kristen, now happily married to Jeff Campbell, the eldest son of the former premier of British Columbia, and now I have two wonderful grandkids, Bowen and Audrey. Silly me. Anyway, we made it up to Sci-Fi Town and had a swell show at the Great American Music Hall, a funky venue that feels like an old vaudeville house. After the performance, there was the inevitable delay as we waited to get paid in cash, and by then, we were starving. Dr. Bill was to drive us to dinner at his favorite haunt, but first we had to stop by the hotel and leave our prop suitcases with the concierge so that early the next day we could take off for our next gig at the University of Colorado in Boulder. But just as we were about to leave, Peter realized he'd left his wallet in his costume pants. Finally, by the time we got to the Trident, Dr. Bill's favorite dining establishment, it was too late. It was closed, and in spite of his pitiful pleas, we didn't get in. "It's all right," Bill assured us. "We'll go to Chinatown. The restaurants are open late there." We drove the narrow streets of San Francisco's Chinatown at around 2 a.m. and found a parking spot right in front of the Golden Dragon restaurant on Washington Street. The three of us got settled inside, and I remember the waiter saying, "You better order now. We're going to close soon." We had no idea how prophetic that was. I ordered some hot and sour soup and other goodies. I was facing the door with Bill to my right and Peter facing me. I bent down to have my second helping of soup and simultaneously heard multiple gunshots, dishes breaking and screaming. It all seemed to happen in the same moment, not separately, like in the movies. Liquid and bits of broken glass flew over my head. I looked up to see three young men wearing nylon stockings over their faces, distorting their Chinese features. One was firing an automatic assault rifle, one was unloading a shotgun, and the third was blasting away with a pistol. I instinctively dropped to the floor, hiding behind the steel pole that supported the small table. Peter, who never fully turned around, dropped to the floor almost in unison with me. I remember thinking it was like we had a wire connecting us, puppets under fire. Bill also followed suit, and all three of us huddled under the table. It's hard to break down moment by moment what it's like to be in a public massacre, although these days it's all too common an occurrence. I remember hearing the shooting continue unabated. As I lay behind the steel column under the table, a torrent of thoughts swirled in my head. Am I going to live to see my unborn child, or am I going to die? Will I be wounded? Will Pete be wounded? Will we have to cancel our tour? But, oddly, I was never scared. I was just angry. The 70s were a time of radical behavior, plane hijackings and shootouts, so I had often daydreamed about how I'd react if I were involved in a dangerous or violent situation. And I like to think that because of those previous fantasies, I instinctively hid immediately, making myself as small a target as possible. And I'm fairly certain that many of those who stood up out of curiosity or tried to run were probably injured or killed. The shooting continued, and my next thought was, I hope they're not going to throw any bombs. And ever the pragmatist during a mass murder, it occurred to me that if they headed down the aisle toward our table, there would be little chance of survival. When the sound of shooting shifted into the next room, I started to feel that we were going to survive. Then I had the strangest thought of all. When you are in the dentist's office and the drilling stops, You can go home. And suddenly, the golden dragon became quiet as the three assailants walked quickly out the front door, the smell of cordite still heavy in the air. One of the owners of the restaurant appeared, waving a huge .45. A little late, guy. Peter got a better look at the shooters during their exit, while I only saw their backs. Because of this, Peter was eventually flown back to San Francisco to testify at the trial that put the three men behind bars. It also helped that the infamous Chinese code of silence was broken because of the community's anger at losing so many innocent lives in a meaningless gangland dispute. Peter and I were untouched. We turned to Bill. "I've been shot," he said. A machine gun slug had ricocheted off the floor, entered the heel of one of his shoes, and radiated up past his Achilles tendon to lodge behind his knee. It remains there to this day. In front of me, a Chinese man was prone in a widening pool of blood, shot in the head. Another man at his table was motionless. I presumed he was dead. And a lovely Asian girl in a sexy slit skirt, her long silky hair splayed across her face, was also it. A cook ran out of the kitchen screaming, "Oh my God, what happened?" A man came up to me, blood pouring from a hand wound. I wrapped a napkin tightly around his hand, gently sitting him down on a chair. A group of young Chinese people, men and women, who were seated behind us, began to file out silently, leaving packs of cigarettes on their table. In support, I patted one of them on the shoulder. I later learned that these were members of the Hua Qing Gang. The Joe Boys, who opened up on the Golden Dragon, did so because of the shooting of Felix Huey, who died in a shootout with the Hua Qing earlier in the year at the Ping Yuen Housing Project. This bloody retaliation for the death of Huey killed 5 people and wounded 11, while all the gang members seated directly behind us were left unscathed. If the Joe Boys had spotted their targets, rather than randomly firing throughout the restaurant, the odds are good that someone else other than me would be telling this story. Random violence is certainly surreal, but the next thing that happened was almost psychedelic. We no sooner learned that Bill had taken a bullet than suddenly, from the front door, a TV news cameraman and a lighting guy burst in. The light and camera swept across the bodies, blood, overturned tables, and shattered dishes, and then they turned and ran out. The reason a TV news crew had arrived before the police was that the Symbionese Liberation Army, responsible for the kidnapping of heiress Patty Hearst, had allegedly called in a bomb threat earlier, and some members of the media actually heard the shooting as they were mere blocks away. The police and triage teams poured in next, determining who was beyond help and who required immediate attention. I had the bizarre experience of seeing the paramedics cut away the dress from the pretty Chinese girl, who we later learned was the daughter of a well-known restaurant owner, to tend to her chest wound. It was an unsettling combination of eroticism and horror. We asked a policeman where the nearest hospital was. Fortunately, it was only 3 blocks away. Peter and I became human crutches for Bill, got him into his car, which you will recall was conveniently parked in front of the restaurant. We stayed with him at the hospital until his wife Lucy, rudely awakened in her bed in Marin County, was able to join him. It was about 4 in the morning when Peter and I got back to our hotel. I called Barbara and said, "We were involved in a gangland shooting. We're okay. You're going to see it on television. Now, don't be alarmed, but I'm sure glad you weren't there." It chilled me to think of her learning on the same day that she was carrying our child and then almost winding up at the massacre with us. The police interviewed us at the hotel the next morning with an 8mm camera to record our testimony, and I handed them a machine gun cartridge I'd picked up from the floor. The biggest cliché in the performing arts is the phrase, "The show must go on." But people had purchased tickets and were waiting to see Procter & Bergman in Boulder, Colorado, the next day. So even though we'd survived a horrific event, our mission was still to make people laugh. On stage that night, we told the disbelieving crowd that we'd been in a gangland shooting in San Francisco, where 5 died and 11 were wounded. But luckily, I announced, I ordered duck. And I got the scared prones, added Peter. He also complained, I never got my fortune cookie. I spoke to Peter later about the Golden Dragon Massacre, and we had some emotional distance from the horror of that night. He told me that when the shooting began, and we had simultaneously dropped to the floor, he imagined a force in the form of a snake traveling up his spine and exiting through his atma, the chakra at the top of the head. He said he then felt the presence of an angel falling over his body protectively and spreading its golden wings over him. Peter was justifiably jumpy for a while after that night. Loud noises and engine backfires startled him. But, amazingly, we continued touring. And I was surprised to see, checking my diaries for 1977 and 1978, that there were Procter & Bergman dates all over the country. If anything good came out of the massacre, besides, of course, not actually dying in it, it was this. I'll never get chosen for jury duty. And, of course, if you're a comedian, you find ways to use your real-life tragedies in your material. My co-writer, Brad Schreiber, saw me and Peter the very next year performing again at the Great American Music Hall. He recalls that at the end of the show, we took our bows and then spoke directly to the crowd. It's great to be back at the Great American Music Hall, Peter beamed. You know, when we were here last year, we were nearly assassinated at the Golden Dragon. Boy, your city sure knows how to make a guy feel welcome. That's right, I agreed. And we escaped injury, but our friend Dr. Bill Alexander, who's here tonight, caught a bullet in his leg. Give him a hand! And Bill, don't stand up. But here's the real kicker. This entire event had been predicted. Months before, after performing at the Bottom Line in New York, I'd received a note backstage that someone named Sharon McCann had called and said that Uri Geller wanted to meet me. This was especially odd, as I had just read about his exploits in a Chicago paper the night before when I excitedly exclaimed to Peter that I wanted to meet this guy Geller, born with a bent spoon in his mouth. After the show, I called the number on the note and was surprised to hear the voice of one of my former Encino housemates, Sharon, who had been married and was now divorced with a young son, hence the unfamiliar last name. She was living in Ossining, New York, and working for Dr. Andrea Puharich, researching psychic and paranormal events, including alien contacts. On my next trip east, I arranged to visit her upstate. It was a sweet and romantic reunion, and she told me some fantastic, and I dare say unbelievable, tales of her adventures in the world of extraterrestrial phenomena. It seemed that she had become a messenger for reverse engineering and traveled the world to present these alien technological revelations, many of which she shared with me. They helped to explain some of the weird incidents that cropped up in my life, like lights mysteriously going on and off around me. Oh, it's the Greys telling you that they like what you and Peter and the Fire Sign are doing to enlighten the world, she explained earnestly. Everything you know is wrong, indeed. And then she grew strangely serious. You know, she whispered, I don't like telling people about bad things that are going to happen, but I feel that I have to tell you something. Okay, Sharon, I said with some trepidation. Shoot. Bad choice of word. Well, yes, Philip, she began hesitantly. You and Peter are going to be involved in a gangland shooting between foreign gangs. Many will be killed and wounded, but you and Peter will escape unharmed. And just when will this happen? I asked. Fairly soon, she concluded. And that was the end of the conversation. It was several months later that her prediction came terribly true. And of course, at that time, her psychic warning didn't even cross my mind. And after all, what could I have done to avoid it? I guess I did what I could under the circumstances, for as Hamlet says, the readiness is all.
We hope you enjoyed the first presentation of the Proctor Podcast, featuring episode one of Where's My Fortune Cookie? Available in print at Amazon.com. To hear more from the series, come back again to the Proctor Podcast for our next episode, uploaded here weekly, when next time, Phil talks about his spiritual, psychic, and generic origins as part of his unique Amish-Irish family history and his rural upbringing in his hometown, Goshen, and Elkhart, Indiana. Until then, this is Tom Kelly saying, thanks for listening.